same seminar, or maybe, yeah, is that what it was?
Yeah.
So Ken has this incredible knack for digging up diamonds out of the rough. I guess he rummages through internet coal mines all day long, or something like that. Somewhere he found Mike. So
through Michael Campbell. That's how he found me.
Oh, Michael Campbell?
Yeah, he referred me.
I don't know Michael Campbell.
Ah, up in Vancouver.
Oh, okay. Is he an SEO guy?
Affiliate marketer.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, you know, the smart people eventually find the smart people. Mike has a really approaches search engine optimization at an entirely different level than most people, than really anybody that I've ever encountered. Most guys are like amateur hackers sticking crowbars in Google, and Mike understands how the whole thing's built from the ground up. And so he's going to go over, you know, what is his framework for understanding SEO, and then we'll go into questions, and you know, he'll take as much as you know we have time for. But at the end of the day, you'll lose it, right? You're going home. So this is your chance. So, Mr. Mike, welcome. Thank you. Glad you're here. From North Carolina, Mike Marshall, my brother.
Thanks, Barry. Start off with kind of one of the show of hands of how many people do some dabbling in the area of SEO themselves at a beginner level, then intermediate, advanced. Okay. So if I refer to anything, say anything that doesn't make sense to you, whatever you have questions about, feel free to ask me to clarify or define something. And I want to give a little bit of background so that you have an idea of what kinds of questions I'm willing to entertain. My background is professionally, primarily IT, programming, software development. Started off doing database development and back-end programming for websites, things like that. It's about a 25-year history, but toward the end, went all the way up to doing artificial intelligence, and which lined up perfectly with my philosophy and linguistics background. So I did a lot of natural language processing. I like to read for fun the technical and white papers that the engineers at Google, Yahoo, and Bing write. So that gives you an idea of what kind of geek I am. But I also do a lot of training is part of what I do in, with my business, consulting, mentoring, coaching, things like that, all related to SEO. And so I have the consulting that I do for companies, the training, and then I write my own software. They're all SEO tools. So any question that you have, however high level or detailed, I can probably address that. And one of the more fun things that I've had the opportunity to do is actually teach a class on search engine technology at the U.S. Patent Office. So they have 150 clerks there. They're all responsible for any patent that is filed related to search engines, whether it's a commercial search engine like Google, Yahoo, Bing, or you know some amateur group. And so I taught a class there, a required class, on the history of search engine technology, the technology itself, the algorithms that are used, and some of the legal and business things that go on in the industry. Acquisitions, intellectual property acquisitions, company acquisitions so they can develop new things, all that kind of stuff. So anyway, that's my background. So what I want to do first is talk about my approach to SEO and how that is, how that is in many ways, very different from what is normally done. Right. So in my approach to SEO, there are two things that I try to do. Or I guess there are two categories of things I try to do. One is I'm always trying to minimize as much as possible trial and error and guesswork as much as I can. The other thing that I'm trying to do is gain some kind of sustainable competitive advantage by learning faster than the competition. Because I'm sure, as you're aware, internet marketing in general, and then definitely the SEO space, is a rapidly changing, sometimes wildly fluctuating arena. You never know what the search engines or your competitors are going to do next. So I first want to ask a question. If you can see this, if anyone recognizes what this might be. It is pretty small, isn't it? So since you can't, I'll tell you what it is. Actually, at one time I did have someone guess exactly what it was. Yeah. This is a page from Einstein's notebook. And we're going to learn something from Einstein today. We'll ask a question. How did Einstein make his leap from or toward the general theory of relativity? What categories of math or mathematical analysis did he use? I've got a number of options up here for you to choose from. All the way from algebra, going all the way up to number theory. Calculus in the middle, differential equations, algebra, geometry. So what do you think, which of these did he have to employ?
It must be theology.
Something not on the
something
list?
Something even higher than that.
Yeah, I assume all of them.
Hmm?
I would assume all of them.
All of them? Okay. That's always that's always one of the choices brought up. Of course, last time someone also said none. All of them. Any others?
Yeah, I mean, I think my favorite is
yeah, something not on the list.
Yeah.
Algebra and geometry. It's all they needed to make his leap toward the general theory of relativity. Why? Because he had a mathematical model that made the work easy for him. Developing a mathematical model can make extremely complex things very simple. Very easy. Move that out of the way. So what does it do, a mathematical model? Well, you use it to describe real-world phenomena. You investigate important questions about the observed world. You explain this real-world phenomenon, and you test your ideas, and then you make predictions about the real world. Very straightforward. And this is just a diagram of a process where you start with the data, formulate a model, do your analysis, come up with some mathematical conclusions, then you interpret that, and hopefully you get some really good explanations and can make some predictions based on that, and then you test that again against real-world data and keep refining it. But one of the interesting things that you have to keep in mind is that the goal is not to explain everything. You're not trying to explain everything about what you're looking at. You're trying to produce the simplest possible model that incorporates the major features of the phenomenon that you're interested in. So it doesn't have to be exhaustive to be effective. And this actually enables you to connect data to understanding. In the realm of internet marketing, you've got boatloads of data, much more data than most people do in traditional marketing. And what you want to do with this data is make sure that you can get understanding and actionable intelligence out of it. You can go a lot further with that if you can take that data and create a mathematical model from it. There are two things that are going to happen. One is that when you create that model, the form of the model itself, before you even do a lot of investigation, the form of the model itself is going to teach you things and allow you to see things that you otherwise could not see. Then, once you throw some more math at it, and do some analysis digging into that model, you're going to glean even further insight. This is an article in Business Week called Math Will Rock Your World. If you do a search in Google for that title and Business Week, it'll come up. And this article explains how mathematical modeling, or what some people call quantitative analysis, is used in a lot of different industries. It's the same fundamental mathematical principles, but it's applied to widely different industries with the same result, in that leaps are made in that industry that improve everything from more efficient processes to impacting the bottom line so that your profits go up. But it's all the same fundamental mathematical principles applied to many different industries. This article goes through and talks a little bit about what that's like, how it's done, and then also kind of like some little case studies in different industries showing what types of differences that it's made. And what it can do in internet marketing is actually enable you to learn faster than your competitors. And in this space, that really is at least a primary sustainable competitive advantage. If you can always learn faster than someone else, and then of course act on it, then that's going to be a huge boost for you. Now, the kind of mathematical modeling that I like to do is very familiar to people who do landing page optimization. Mostly involves multivariate analysis, which is used a lot in landing page testing and conversion rate optimization. In fact, you know, Google even has their page optimizer that employs multivariate analysis and multivariate testing. And it's known pretty well on the PPC side of internet marketing, but not SEO. It's not used as much. But that's what I do. So I wanted to give you this little intro so you can at least have a little bit of background about my approach. So what I like to do is I look at competitive landscapes. And that is, you got a target key phrase that you're trying to rank for, and instead of basing what you're going to do as far as what do you change on your pages, what do you change on your site, what do you change as far as your off-page factors, on SEO best practices, general guidelines or rules, I actually base it on what's happening in that competitive landscape. There are a number of things that are glaring mistakes in the SEO community and the way they understand how things work. And I'm going to talk about a couple of those, but first I want to talk about what a search engine is, because this leads to these two huge mistakes. Or misunderstanding this leads to these two huge mistakes. So the first thing to understand is that a search engine, with regard to natural search, has three main goals. It is an information retrieval system, so it has to do three things: recall, precision, and ranking. Recall says, give me everything I ask for. Precision says, give me only what I ask for. Ranking says, give it to me in a meaningful order. If you understand what those three things are and what they mean, then you can know what a search engine has to do, what it cannot do, and what it will never do, because it has to achieve those three goals. So an example is, there used to be a debate for a very long time in the SEO community over something called the sandbox. And this was the idea that for brand new sites, you just put your site up, goes live, that if you want to get some visibility in Google, you've got to wait a while. It's kind of like a trial period. And not until you're maybe a couple of weeks, maybe a month old, will you even start to get any traction at all. Because they have this, not really a penalty, because you haven't done anything wrong, but just a holding pattern for about a month. And Matt Cutts, who's the chief engineer of spam at Google, would often get asked at conferences, tell us more about the sandbox. There's this debate, wondering, what is it really like? How long do you have to stay in the sandbox? Who gets put in it? Can you get out of the sandbox faster? Can you expedite that process? They would ask all kinds of questions like this. And Matt Cutts would always respond by saying, there is no sandbox. And instead of taking his answer and taking him at his word, they would just roll their eyes. Most people would say, yeah, he has to say that. Of course he does. Come on, tell us really. What's it like? How long do you have to really stay in there? And it just ignored him. But if you knew that they had those three main goals, recall, precision, and ranking, you would know that for a commercial search engine, having something like a holding pattern for all new websites for a month is ludicrous, right? Because what do you end up with? A search engine where all of the information is at least 1 month old. That doesn't make any sense at all, does it? But the SEO community used to debate over this back and forth. It really was almost like 50-50. Half of the people believing there was a sandbox, the other half not believing it, nobody listening to Matt Cutts. But all you had to do is know what the search engine is supposed to do. Just think about it for a second and you realize this is ludicrous that there would be something like this.
Well, if you watch Cool Hand Luke, they have a box and it's worse than a sandbox. You know, if that's the script you're running on.
Yeah. And it might be. So, anyway, we'll come back to these three things. Recall, precision, and ranking. Another thing is most people in the SEO community believe that search engines grade everything on an absolute scale. So you've got your pages, you've picked your target key phrase, you're about to do some optimization, and you're figuring out, what does my page need to look like? I've got my title tag, I've got my copy, I've got some links coming in, I got link text, I got to figure out how many words in my title tag do I need? How many words in my description tag? How many words in my copy? What's my keyword density? And so you can search and you can find recommendations that people give. They'll say, for example, for your title tag, make sure it's about 9 to 12 words. For your copy, make sure your keyword density for your target key phrase is between 2 and 4%. If it's too low, it won't be seen as relevant. If it's too high, it'll be seen as spammy, and you'll get penalized for that. All kinds of rules like this. And so you take these rules, and you implement them on your site, and that's how you're going to get high visibility. And there are people who spend countless hours doing all kinds of research and correlation analysis to come up with what this set of rules is going to be. And you'll have one guru that has one set of rules, and another guru has an overlapping but somewhat conflicting set of rules based on their tests. And so a lot of people will look at it and say, well, this guy, he researched 1,000 key phrases. This one says he researched 10,000 key phrases. And so then you have someone else that kind of slaps them all together and makes an average. And so you take this list, and this is how you employ, this is how you go about doing SEO. Both individual kind of one-man shops, small firms, and large SEO firms. They all follow this type of process. So what happens is this. You get the list, you do what it says, and you don't see yourself rising up to the first page right away. But then you figure, okay, there's some tweaking that has to be done. So you do some tweaking, change this, change that, 3 or 4 months go by, and you start to see some real traction. And what you end up with does not look like the list of recommendations that you started with. But that's okay because you need to do some tweaking. That's the way it works. So the next project you get, the next site, the next client, the next key phrase, you go back to the same list and you start in the same way and you get the same phenomenon. You tweak for 3-4 months, then you start to see some traction. Now when I explain this, whenever I would explain this at the patent office teaching there, I would always get these chuckles, and I asked one guy, you know, why are you guys laughing? He said, it sounds like the definition of insanity. Why do these guys keep going back to a list of rules that don't work? I said, well, because for some reason they think the search engines really do have a hard set parameter list of what they're looking for. And if you don't fall between this, no matter what industry, no matter what website, no matter what key phrase, if you don't fall between this, you're not going to be on the first page. The problem is that is not the way the search engines work. They never have worked that way. Search engines grade on a curve. What it takes to make it to the first page or even the number one varies from key phrase to key phrase. And so a generic list is not going to put you where you need to be. You are always going to be spinning your wheels for a few months especially in really, really competitive key phrases. You're going to spin your wheels for a few months with this type of methodology, which is why it's almost universally true among SEO firms that offer a contract, that they will tell you, don't expect to see any results for the first 6 months. The reason why is because it takes them 6 months to figure out what they need to be doing. But the entire industry, SEO, has come to expect that as normal. Clients don't know to expect anything different, and the vendors don't know to do anything differently. That's just the way it is. But it doesn't have to be that way if you approach it differently. If you understand first, and this is probably the most important thing, that the search engines grade on a curve. They grade everything on a curve. And what that means is something very important. What everyone does in a competitive landscape, the guys that are ranking for the same key phrase, what everyone does affects what everyone else has to do. When somebody else changes what they're doing, that changes how effective what you've already done continues to be. So think of it this way. We're in a class. We're taking an exam. It's graded on a curve. It matters who's in the class, doesn't it? If some really smart person walks into the class, we all know we've got to work harder, right? If you're the smartest person in the class, you know your job's going to be easy. So instead of trying to reverse engineer the algorithm, which is what a lot of these people are trying to do with their correlation analysis and study and things like that, you really just need to look at your competition and learn from them in the right way. So I want to say something about reverse engineering the algorithm first. People attempt to do this with Google, Yahoo, and Bing, and many think they've succeeded to a certain degree. It's when they come up with this list, I know what the algorithm is, they really don't. It's impossible to reverse engineer Google's algorithm. And it's not because you don't have enough computer power, you didn't gather enough data. It's because it's literally mathematically impossible. There are some mathematical processes involved that cannot be reverse engineered. Like you can't unscramble scrambled eggs, or you can't unbake a cake. It just cannot be done. It's impossible. But people don't know this. They think they can reverse engineer it. And a lot of processes in SEO that are based on this assumption that you can reverse engineer the algorithm. And people make a lot of mistakes doing that. So, don't try it. Don't algorithm chase. All you have to do is look at your competitors in the right way. So here's the way it works. A search engine is going to look at the competitors who are relevant to a particular key phrase, and they're going to grade on a curve in two ways. They grade the competitors against each other on a curve, and they grade the SEO factors against each other on a curve. So for some target key phrases, certain SEO factors are more important than others, where for another key phrase, it may not be. So for one key phrase, it may be the case that the number of words in your copy, as far as on-page factors, is really important. For another key phrase, it may not matter at all. For one target key phrase, how many different domains are linking to you is more important for ranking well. For another key phrase, it doesn't have that much influence. All of it has to do with what all the competitors are doing. So I'll tell you a case study. A company, Drs. Foster and Smith, was ranking for the key phrase pet supplies on the first page, number 6, for a number of years. And all of a sudden, they dropped to number 12. They weren't sure why. They were very meticulous in the records that they kept for every change on their page, and they were very methodical in going about making changes. So they started tweaking this, tweaking that, to try to figure out what they could do to get back on the first page. And after about 7 months of this, they got nowhere. They never got worse. They never dropped. But they didn't budge at all moving upward. They just stayed at 12. So soon after that, they became a client. And in addition to the things I was normally going to do in my contract, they said, figure out why this happened and fix it. And I said, okay, no problem. So I looked at it, and I did my analysis, and I figured out something that was very interesting that they would never have guessed at from their experience, and that is they were not very far from getting back to number six. The entire time, they were this close. Here's why they didn't know that, and why most people in SEO wouldn't have been able to tell them that that was the case, or tell them why. When we look at a search result listing, we see a nice linear ordering, right? So let's say this is the guy that's number one, here's someone that's number nine. We see how far apart they are, and they say, well, this guy, he's got quite a bit to make up to reach number one. And we're looking at it this way. Now, when we see changes, if you watch this for a while, you rarely see anyone gradually move down. One, two, three, four, five, as they're dropping in ranking. Or the reverse, moving up methodically, one space at a time. It's like this, it's jumping all over the place. And we think that's crazy. People say, you know, Google's schizophrenic or something like that. It's not what's happening at all. The problem is, you're looking at a very thin slice of what's really going on. You're looking at one dimension. It's really more than that. So let's suppose we've got two dimensions, vertical and horizontal, right? So same two virtual competitors here. Now let's do this, right? So vertically, they're still the same distance apart, but horizontally, they're very close, right? Now, let's suppose the horizontal axis is actually more important. It's weighted more heavily than the vertical. And we only see the vertical. We don't know these guys are really close to each other. We can't see that. All we see is this. And that's what's happening. Except it's not two dimensions. It's 200 at least. Being graded at the same time, being weighted differently from key phrase to key phrase, all at the same time. My analysis showed me, looking at multiple dimensions at the same time, that they were this close. And it told me also which SEO factors needed to be changed to make up the difference and how they needed to be changed. It also told me why they dropped. They didn't drop because they did something by mistake or even intentionally to their page that Google didn't like. In fact, they did nothing at all. They just dropped. The reason why they dropped is because two other competitors on the second page moved up to the first page, and they changed the rules of the game. What they had that put them and kept them at number six for years was just not good enough anymore. They had to learn from how the rules changed, then they knew what to do. But they would have kept going on and on and on and probably never figured out exactly what they need to do because they were never looking in the right place. So that's the difference it makes and the approach that you have to how you're going to go about looking at SEO. You can flounder around and accidentally stumble upon things sometimes, but it's much better to, out of the gate, know what you're doing. So, I'm going to go over some things fairly quickly.
Can I ask a question before you segue?
Mm-hmm.
Is there any correlation to, as Google's picking out the group of things that go on the first page, going back to your three things that you said that they're looking for, but is there ever, we want to give a variety of potential options? So my sense is when I do a Google search, I'll get one thing, Google thinks this is what it is, but the next thing's not generally related directly to that one, and they'll take another, if there's another listing that's close to that, they'll drop it significantly down the next page or whatever. Is there a component of that? So if two very closely aligned competitors could be six or eight spaces apart because Google says, well, let's give some additional selections in there.
If you factor in personalization, yes. Does everyone know how personalization works? It's basically each searcher sees a different ordering of the search results because of what their preferences and tastes are that Google can discern from their history interacting with the search results. Whether you have a Google account or not, whether you think you have history turned on or not, personalization is always at work. So that would be something where Google has an idea of the different ranges and types of things you might like And what they do is, in addition to the normal algorithm, they shuffle the results based on what they think you might find interesting. And so they will, in some sense, give an artificial boost to some pages because of who's doing the search. So in that sense, you might find some things that kind of show a broad spectrum of pages that are related to the search. I don't know if that answers your question.
I think so.
Okay. Yes?
More a specific question that plays off of what you just said of personalization. I heard you speak at the system seminar a couple of years ago, and being aware of the personalization, I've been using the AdWords preview tool that is designed for pay-per-click.
Yeah.
Is that, would that be kind of as close to removing the personalization for SEO? I mean, just to see where we rank things?
No. And here's the reason why. There is no such thing anymore as where you rank. There's only where you see where you show up in the results. There is no monolithic set of search results. There really is no number one, number two, number three, number four, except for looking at the core algorithm results. And there's only one way to see that. And that is, you do your search. After your search is returned, you go to the address bar and you add a parameter at the end of the URL. Once you add that parameter and hit return, then you'll see the search results and there will be no personalization in there.
And what's that?
What is that parameter?
Oh, you want me to tell you?
Of course! The suspense. Well, you know, we got one of those for different countries of AdWords results. Why wouldn't we want to know this for ampersand?
This is the part where you're right, MikeMarshall.com/something. That's a rarity ad. Call
yeah.
Mike here.
That's it. PWS equals zero. No one knows how much longer it will continue to work. It's not a supported feature. Not supported anywhere. You can't navigate to it. There's no button you can press or anything. But that's what does it. It still does it. Last time I checked, which would be like last week. So that way you can see what the normal results are when there's no personalization. The problem is no one sees that. Almost no one sees that. What those results are. With that parameter. So you still don't know where you rank. But it is important, really important, to know where you show up. Because personalization is not a different algorithm for each person. They're still the same core algorithm. And then the deck is shuffled. You need to make sure you at least show up in the deck, right, before it gets shuffled. And getting a search result with this will tell you where do you show up in the deck to begin with before it gets shuffled.
Are you working on, or do you already have some sort of thing that calculates, like gets like estimations for like the different possibilities that people could see?
No, because you don't need that. I have two tools. One, which does this part for you. It tells you on a core algorithm, where do you show up in the deck? If you're not in the deck, how do you get into the deck? So it shows you for each key phrase, what you need to do to make sure you're faring well on the core algorithm. Then I have a second tool that helps you figure out what you need to do to make sure when the deck gets shuffled that you float to the top. And that is a matter of actually having supporting terms that support your key phrase that are semantically relevant and also relevant in other ways. So the way this tool works is you put in a key phrase and you put in your URL. It goes out, looks at all your competition, uses some natural language processing to analyze all their copy and check it against Google and see what's going on. And it gives you a list of terms that will boost your relevance to that key phrase. And they're grouped in blocks that have different levels of relevance boost. And you just go down the list and pick one from the first 7 to 10 color blocks. That will improve your relevance. It also will improve your quality score for PPC. and lower your minimum bid. But in SEO, it helps you become more relevant in a broader way for that key phrase, which is what helps you float to the top for more people doing searches when personalization kicks in. So this new era of search engines with personalization has kind of split SEO into two kind of things that have to be done. There's the core algorithm that has to be dealt with and the competitive intelligence that needs to be done. And then there's the personalization that has to be addressed. So that's a long answer to a very short question, but any other questions before I segue into the next thing? All right, I wanted to talk about some common SEO factors that are addressed in SEO and what you should and should not be doing with respect to those. So the first thing, this has always been true, the title tag is the most important on-page element, regardless of your key phrase. And knowing what you should do with your title tag falls into two categories. There's one thing that's always true, and that is have your target key phrase as close to the front of the title tag as possible. What you don't know is how long your title tag has to be, or what your keyword density has to be for the title tag. There is no universal rule for that. Regardless of what you read online, there's no universal rule for that. You have to look at your competitive landscape and figure out what it needs to be. But it's always true that the closer you have to the front of the title tag, your key phrase, the better off you'll be. Then you've got your copy. Well, you've got something in the middle, your meta tags. Don't worry about keyword meta tags. They don't do you any good. The only thing it can do is hurt you if you do it incorrectly. In case you want to have your keyword meta tags in there anyway, here's what's incorrect. Do not have any key phrase in your keyword meta tag that does not show up in your copy. That's the number one rule. No term in your key phrase meta tag that does not show up in your copy on that page. If you're really egregious with your keyword meta tag, some people will have like 50 words in their keyword meta tag, keyword stuffing. You might get penalized for that. But if you craft your keyword meta tag perfectly, you get no brownie points for that, nothing at all. The only thing you do is tip off to your competition what key phrases you're targeting. That's it.
So get rid of meta.
Just get rid of them. No, there's no reason to keep them there. Description meta tags have no impact on ranking, but it does influence your click-through rate. So when you craft your description meta tag, think of it the way you would as the creative for an ad in PPC. Its main purpose is to get the person to click. Then your copy. The main thing that most people will obsess over are the length of the copy and the keyword density for your target key phrase. So the length of the copy and what's needed varies. Generally, the longer it is, the better, because you have more of a chance, in a sense, of proving to Google that you're relevant. If you don't want to do that, you can always compensate for that with off-page factors, with links. So that's always kind of a way that that works. Whatever you can't do on-page for a weakness like relevance, you can make up for it with off-page factors. But off-page factors are harder. So length of copy, longer is better to persuade the search engine that you're really relevant. Keyword density is something that is kind of a part and parcel of doing SEO, but it doesn't matter. Keyword density does not matter. You don't need to obsess over it. What is more important is something called keyword proximity. So in the example I'll give you, it'll be really apparent. Let's say you've got two documents. Each document has 100 words. In the first document, the first word is dog, and the second word is food. So what is the keyword density for dog food in that first document?
Or which keyword?
Dog food, yeah.
One.
2%.
2%.
And the second document, it's 100 words. The first word is dog. The last word is food. This is the only time, only places those words appear. What's the keyword density?
2%.
2%. It's the same. Which document is more likely to be about dog food?
First one.
The first one. But the keyword density is exactly the same. What's different is the proximity. The search engines know this. It's plainly obvious. And when you read their technical papers, they don't talk about keyword density. They always talk about proximity. It is always a better measurement of relevance than keyword density. And it is no harder to calculate. But the SEO community has always been obsessed with keyword density. And copywriters have hated it. Right? Give someone some copy. Oh, and while you're writing, make sure that the keyword density is right around 3.57%. And then you say, oh, we need some more copy. Can you throw in another paragraph? Oh, and while you're doing it, make sure the keyword density stays at 3.57%. And they come back the next month and tell them, oh, the algorithm has shifted. Now it needs to be 4%, right? Copywriters hate this. It's a copywriter's nightmare. And that's not what you need to do. But people spend a lot of time working on it. So that's one thing that you should avoid. Worry about proximity. And there is a really sophisticated way to calculate that, but a good rule of thumb is to look at your copy and ask yourself if the target key phrase is nicely, evenly distributed throughout the copy, top, middle, and bottom. And that's it. And then walk away. Move on to the next thing. So, that's really the only thing you need to know about on-page factors in most cases. So then there comes off-page factors, which are generally more important. Off-page factors can trump on-page factors all day long, every day. There's just more weight put on them in general. And the more competitive the key phrase, the more important those off-page factors are going to be. So there are a number of things that you need to keep in mind. First, the link text that you use should not be 100% the same. So you have a page and you've got 100 links pointing to that page. They should not all say, if your target key phrase is fruit bowl, your link text should not be fruit bowl on every single page that's linking to you. The only exception is if the link text is your company name, your domain name, or perhaps it could be the name of a person if that page is about that person. Then it's okay. But if it's not matching that criteria, it doesn't look natural. Google looks at it this way. You're going and asking for opinions about a product. And no matter who you go to, they give you the same 15-word spiel, word for word. Right? That doesn't look natural. That looks contrived. So Google thinks, because they look at a link as a vote from one page to another, they think that that is unnatural. Everybody is using the same exact link text, unless it's the company name, which makes sense. So you want to vary it a bit. For your target key phrase, and you look at all the links that are coming in, you shouldn't have more than 50%. I mean, that's like top. 50% of those links have your key phrase in it, your exact key phrase. All the other links should have some other link text. It can be related words and terminology. It can be things like click here, go here for more information, your company name, whatever. But never go higher than 50% on the link text linking in. Now, where you get your link matters. If your link is placed in the footer, not as valuable. Sidebar, not as valuable. Embedded in copy is always more valuable than any other place on a page. So you want lots of copy surrounding it, and you want that copy to be relevant to what's being linked to. And you want the page copy to be relevant to the link text, which is relevant to the page being linked to. And in recent months, because of the Penguin update, it has actually become important for the site itself to belong to a niche that's related to what's being linked to. not just the page being relevant. Now, you know about the difference between nofollow and dofollow links? So a nofollow attribute in a link means don't pass any link juice from this page to the next one. Some people obsess over links that are only dofollow because, well, I'm not going to get any SEO benefit from a link that has a nofollow attribute in it. So why should I bother with those? Go after the dofollow links. Having nofollow links actually helps you because Google thinks it's natural to have a certain amount of nofollow links. And if you don't have them, that looks unnatural. Yes?
Can you just elaborate on what a dofollow link versus a nofollow link is?
Yeah.
Show you what it looks like. They started doing this because of blog comment spam.
What did you call it?
Blog comment spam.
And it solves the whole issue of blog comment spam, as we all know.
Yeah.
No problem anymore.
Obviously, it didn't solve the problem. But this is what you would put in the anchor tag, REL equals, and then in quotes, no follow. And what this does is it makes the link that that's part of not pass any SEO juice to what's being linked to. So people would put this in their template so that any link that's in a comment has that nofollow attribute, and the comment spammers get no SEO benefit from flooding blog comment threads with their spam, with the links on there. And this was supposed to discourage people from continuing to do blog comment spam. So that's why it's there. There's some other uses for it too, but that was the original reason. So when you have this, people will look at that and say, well, I don't want to link from there because it's going to be no follow. I'm not going to get any SEO benefit. The irony is that you need some of those. And if you don't have any or too low a percentage of them, it looks unnatural. And then that will be a disadvantage for you for SEO. So they don't have direct SEO benefit, but they do have indirect SEO benefit. The other thing that people obsess over is getting links from pages that have a high Google page rank. So a PR5, a PR6, a PR7, they want as many of those as they can get, which is also a mistake. Didn't used to be a mistake, but it is now. Because most of the websites on the internet are very low quality. And it looks unnatural if most of your links are from high Google PageRank pages. It should follow, literally, a power law distribution, or the 80-20 rule. If you can see the distribution of the sites that link to you that have high Google PageRank, middle Google PageRank, and low Google PageRank, it should look like a power law distribution. And that is not like, it's not really a guess or a rule of thumb. That is precisely what they look for. They actually have algorithms to detect the spamminess of a page by looking at whether or not the power law distribution is followed with link text and with Google PageRank. It just so happens to be the case that they do this because that is what is natural. Without anyone trying to do it, that's the way incoming links and outbound links behave on just regular sites. A site that's big enough to get links, that's been out long enough, they will all show a power law distribution in that way. And when people are trying to force it, they break that distribution pattern. And it sticks out like a sore thumb to the algorithm. And they penalize you for it.
Are these things that are also different between key phrases like the stuff earlier? Like
no.
The power law distribution is different? Or just like that is
that's it. It's the power law distribution. That does not vary from key phrase to key phrase.
But still, Google itself supports SEO to a certain level.
Mm-hmm.
So as soon as you start working on attracting links, you are, by definition, screwing up this natural distribution, is what I think.
Yeah, that's the conundrum. That's the conundrum with SEO.
SEO inherently is. yeah. trying to break the system. So
yeah.
Right.
We're constantly trying to fight against SEO.
Right. I mean, basically what they have to do is make sure no one games the system.
Right.
Right. They're trying their hardest to make sure that whatever they see structurally in their web graph actually is going to return results that are relevant to the user. Now, they've got a lot of other feedback mechanisms to double check that. And that's one of the things personalization does for them. But you still need to do these things. I mean, it's just common sense. When you want to get visibility in the search engine to try to figure out, well, what does Google want? Right? And how can I beat my competitors? Those are the two questions that you're looking at when you're doing SEO. What does Google want, and how do I do it better than my competitors? And there's no way they can avoid that. But what they do need to avoid is people gaming the system by looking like they're relevant and important when they're not. And what you need to do is doing SEO is to make sure you don't appear irrelevant when you are. Because Google has a guilty until proven innocent approach. And so if it looks like you're gaming the system, you're irrelevant. They don't have time to cherry pick and say, well, this guy's okay, that guy's okay, that guy's okay. If you look like you're up to something nefarious, you're guilty. And they penalize you and ask questions later. Yes?
So since there's no sandbox, when you make changes, how long should it take before you see results?
Well, there are two things that are going to impact that. One, how quickly Google picks up the new change, right? So you look at your cache date. Mm-hmm. And you can look at the cache date of, I would say look at the cache date for the other pages on the first page of results to get an idea of how frequently Google is crawling those pages. And that'll give you an idea of how long to wait. There are two things that influence this phenomenon. One, how much that key phrase is searched. So, for example, if you look at Google's keyword tool and you see the dips and valleys in search volume, right? If you see a scenario where you expect the search volume is going to go up, you can expect that the time you have to wait to see changes is going to shrink. Because the more searches there are, the more urgency they put on refreshing the results.
Sure.
The other thing is, the higher your Google page rank, the more frequently your site will be crawled. Same thing with the other competitors. So those are the things that influence that. But your first trigger is going to be looking at the cache dates to see that everybody's gotten a new, fresh update. And if the last one was like 2 weeks ago, then it's going to take time before you see anything. Other questions?
Since Google's becoming more and more sensitive to, you know, the quality of all site optimization, is it actually becoming more and more possible for you to be able to, are you more able to address your competitors actually damaging your link profile by pulling more of these high PR links to you and making your profile look unnatural?
Yes. You are. There's always been a little cottage industry for negative SEO. But because of recent changes, it's actually easier to do it. And there have been some recent tests that people have run to try to see if some of these things that used to be really hard have become a little easier. And they've become easier for two reasons. One, Google is penalizing for certain types of links in ways that they weren't before. Because they're penalizing for them instead of just neutralizing the effect, someone else can go out and get links like that, point them to you, and then you'll be penalized. The other thing is that there are some links that they're not penalizing you for, but they're sapping all the link juice out of it because they don't like it. And so you will drop in ranking, and your backlink profile will shrink. You think you've got 10,000 links coming into your site, but there are really only 500 that Google is actually counting. The other 9,500, they're not even looking at anymore, which makes you more vulnerable to negative SEO attacks. The smaller or the weaker your backlink profile is, the easier it is for someone else to cause you to tank by giving you bad links. And unlike penalties, for example, where, let's say you penalize because you keyword stuffed your title tag, you just put fruit bowl, after, you know, that's your whole title tag, right? Your keyword stuffing. You get penalized for that. So you go back in and you clean up your title tag and you'll float back to where you were. That's how you recover from a penalty. You do not recover from the penguin update because it's an algorithm update. So if they decide we're going to sap the link juice out of 80% of your links, some people say, well, let's go and remove all those links. Just remove them, and then we'll float back to where we were. No, you won't. You were there because of those links, and they were counting. They don't count anymore, so you drop. Getting rid of them doesn't fix the problem. You need to go out and get 9,000 new links, and you can't get... That depends on how Google feels. It is, well, it does. It really depends on how egregious they think it is. And there's also a difference between whether the pages are de-indexed or not de-indexed, all kinds of stuff like that. But the main thing you have to do is get quality links to replace the bad ones that now have no juice. And you can't do it quickly. And that's the problem with most people right now in the aftermath of Penguin, is that they figured, okay, I went out and I accumulated these 5,000 links in like 2 months. Gave me a good ranking boost, sat there pretty for quite a while. Now I'm dropped to the fifth page. So what I'm going to do? Okay, so I got to get another 5,000 links. I'll just go out and get 5,000 quality links. And you try to figure out a fast way to do it. But link velocity is another thing that they look at to see if it's quality or low quality. So you've got to replace those links, and you've got to do it slowly, unless you have a lot of cloud cover. And cloud cover is basically background noise in the world of link building. So if you are regularly getting lots of links from lots of different places, you have lots of background noise, and you can afford to ratchet up links faster. But if you've got no background noise going on, because all the links you were ever getting were all ones that you went out and got yourself in some kind of artificial way, then you're in trouble. But if you've got some stuff going on, like a lot of social media activity, and you're getting some brownie points for that, and that's creating a buzz, then you've got some cloud cover and you can ratchet up with the links. But there are ways to calculate how fast you can have a spike and how long you can sustain at that level before you come back down. But that's where the community is left because of Penguin. Yes?
So are you saying we're kind of defenseless against negative SEO?
Yes, you are defenseless against negative SEO.
And that is the goal, to scare you.
Yeah, there's no way to stop it from happening to you. There's only a way to make it harder for them to do it, and in some ways deter people from doing it, because if your backlink profile is strong enough, they're going to say it's not worth trying to take this guy out. It's going to take too much effort. We'll have to put so much effort into it that we will stick out like a sore thumb to Google, and they'll tank us instead. Yes?
You're saying basically that if you suspect a lot of your links at the deep value, basically you can stop counting them. Shouldn't waste time just going back to each website and getting rid of those things.
That's
one thing I'm
thinking. If you can, I would do it. Yeah, but if you can't, just worry about getting good quality links.
Google did send out, what was it, like 700,000?
Yes, 700,000 alerts.
Google went back to tools basically saying that, okay, your link profile is funny.
Right.
Check it out and give us a something a consideration. What do you recommend doing when you're faced with that? Just ignore it or actually try to get something done? Because I do think that a manual penalty does exist, and MacDuff said something about that before. So.
Yeah, there are manual penalties. There are some that aren't. With the unnatural link alert, I would suggest the following course of action. The first thing you should do is try to get rid of any links that you can, that you see don't meet Google's quality guidelines. The second thing that you should do is look at Google's report for what they say are links pointing to you and see if you see anything in there that's a problem and try to get any of those taken down if you can. The next thing that you should do is look at everything else in your Google Webmaster Tools account to see if there are any other errors. Crawling errors, 404 errors, duplicate content errors, and clean them all up before you do the next thing, which is file a report to Google about the unnatural links. And I would hesitate and debate for a very long period of time before you decide to submit a report to Google about your unnatural links.
It's like clicking the unsubscribe button from a spam email. Right?
That's right. It's like clicking the unsubscribe button. Think long and hard before you do it.
Fast flyer list.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Or Chairman Mao inviting all the poets and dissidents to come forward with their opinions so that he can tie their mouths shut and starve them to death.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So basically, if I could say, for instance, you don't need to suspect that this, the recent ranking problems are still too much unnatural link. I mean, it's just a bit of devaluing of your existing link. You shouldn't just go through the user rating request, right?
Right.
Yeah.
I have a few things. First is just a testimonial for your software because I did purchase it at the system seminar. And it just removes all the guessing from the SEO stuff. We use the data there for SEO, but we also use that data for our landing pages. And I haven't really monitored very closely to actually record numbers, but I have noticed for sure quality scores have gone up. Click-through rates improving, or cost per click improving, and stuff like that. But I have a couple of questions. One is if you could elaborate a little bit more on the controversy over duplicate content.
Mm-hmm.
And then second, is there a difference between, if I have inbound links to specific articles on my page, does that boost my overall website, or is the ranking the value of those links based on each individual page on my site?
Okay. First question on duplicate content is you can think of it in two ways. This duplicate content on your own site. That's actually more accurately the description of what's going on with a duplicate content penalty. You've got the same content on multiple pages on your site. Sometimes it happens accidentally because you've got multiple URLs pointing to the same content. You don't have five different pages. You've got one page, but five URLs will get you there. And that also causes a duplicate content issue because the search engines divide the world up into URLs, not pages. Having the same title tag and description tag combination repeated across your site is also something that will give you a duplicate content penalty. Not just the content, but the title tag and a meta description combination needs to be unique across your pages. As far as the copy on the pages themselves, no one knows what percentage of similarity is the threshold for duplicate content or not duplicate content. No one knows. But make it as different as possible. And make the uniqueness between the pages as early as possible. Those are the things that are pretty certain. So if you've got a lot of similarity, make sure at least at the beginning it's very different, like that first paragraph. If you have duplicate content issues because you've got a slightly different version of your page for different audiences, so let's say Canada, UK, US, that kind of thing, if you have a different TLD, you don't have to worry about duplicate content. So if you've got .com for one, .co.uk for the other, .ca for the other, even if the content on those sites are almost identical, you won't get a duplicate content penalty.
Bill eventually fixed that.
Yeah, eventually. the second part was...
Well, actually, so duplicate content is an issue only within your website, not necessarily a problem if I post an article on my website and then I have someone else post that same article on their website.
Right.
That's not an issue.
Yeah, that's just syndication. The only thing you end up with there is that Google is not going to rank every version of that. They're going to pick whichever one is strongest, and that's the one that's going to get the visibility. Sometimes what happens, and what you have to worry about, is the copied version of it might outrank yours if it gets more attention and it's better optimized. So you have to worry about that.
So you're not penalized for it, but you're not awarded for it. And
right.
Only the best one wins.
Right.
Makes sense.
Yep.
So that could hurt you if you, like, that's a high-ranking page for your site, and then you go and submit it to somebody else's site, and their site is higher-ranking than yours overall. They'll take away the power from yours.
Right.
Okay. And then the next question has to do with inbound links that aren't going to the home page, but might be going to various pages
Right.
of the site. How does that work?
You actually want lots of links that come into your site that are not going to the home page. If they go to, I guess, an internal page, like an article or something like that, that definitely helps that page is linking to, but it also helps your site as a whole. It's what's called the benefit of deep linking. So the deeper the page in your site, the more boost you get for your site as a whole when there's a link going to it. So you're looking at, normally we think of directories, two directories deep, three directories deep. So that's deep internal linking. Now, the important thing that you should keep in mind is that Google does not determine how deep something is by how many slashes there are in the URL. They don't care how many slashes there are in the URL. They look at click pattern. So how many clicks does it take to get to that page? That's how deep it is, not how many slashes there are. If you have any background in server administration, you know why that would be the case. All you got to do is come up with virtual paths, and you could have everything be on the top level, right?
Everything is
deep. Right. So you could have a totally flat structure in the URL, or everything could be deep. So they care about click paths. How many clicks does it take to get there? But the deeper the page, you have links coming in, it really helps your site as a whole.
So it's like, how many looks does it take to get to the center?
Yeah, exactly.
So like, this, one thing I've always wondered is the way URLs are. Does having stuff in the categories and slashes, in my preference, has always been, you know, conversion rate focus, which is just like simple URL with the slash and then basically real words with dashes in between them, without all these different categories, ////.
Right.
Is there an advantage to the slashes and like actually putting things into categories and subcategories and having the slashes represent those, the layers and all that?
There's an advantage to putting things, to grouping things in categories. There's not an advantage to the slashes. There's more an advantage to the internal linking structure of the site.
Okay.
So pages that are about the same thing link to each other. They don't link to things that are very different. So if you've got a site that sells shoes and one that's and a section that sells hats, the hat categories can link to each other, but pages, detail pages on hats should not link to detail pages on shoes. It should only link to other things that are like them.
So that kind of applies to the whole date in the URL.
Right.
Really making a difference.
Right.
Okay. I was wondering that too. That's that for years I just ignored it and just got rid of it and made my own custom URL because I just didn't like the way it looked, but I figured there was a reason for why they had it, but I guess not, it's not really that important, so it's good.
Right.
Is a sitemap important for SEO?
Yes, it is. They expect to see one. They think that's, well, there are two things. There's an XML sitemap that the human visitor never uses. That's important to make sure everything gets indexed. But then there's a human sitemap that Google sees as important for user experience. And if you have one, you get brownie points for it.
Brownie point indicator.
I should, shouldn't I? Brownie point indicator. Yes.
What about subdomains?
Subdomains. I avoid them. only because search engines are not consistent in how they treat them, and a particular search engine tends not to be consistent over time in how they treat them. Right now, they're fine, but it depends on what you're trying to figure out. So, for example, if you figure you want that subdomain to be treated as a separate site, it may be treated that way, it may not, depending on which search engine and what year it is. So I tend to avoid them.
Does that carry over to the www, non-www
thing? No, that's different, because you can, you can consolidate that. It's not fixed in the sense that it really doesn't matter.
Okay.
They will get treated as two separate sites.
Still.
Wow. Yeah, still. Wow. You do have to put in that 301 redirect to solve that.
So we're going back to the content and the TLDs. You mentioned earlier that as long as you kind of own the different TLDs, won't matter if your content.
Right.
It only apply if the domain that you own is exactly the same, and they're both on the same Webmaster Tools account. Or
No, they don't have to be on the same Webmaster Tools account. But the domain name.
It's not enough that it's registered under the same company name. It has to be the exact same domain name.
Yeah, it needs to be the same domain name.
And it's not what you recommend that. It has to be completely different content.
Yeah. Yeah, as different as possible. Otherwise, you're going
to
choose one over the other.
Tools and specify the geographic target.
That would help. Yeah. If you
Australia, one, New Zealand.
Yeah. If you specify a geographic target, that would help.
So it won't matter if they're if these two sites that don't have the exact same domain name.
Right.
Share the same content, geographic targeting is different.
Right, because then they'll know they won't have to choose one over the other in the search results.
So make sure you talk about your software.
Yes, my software is available to you at a special price. There are three tools that are bundled together. One does...
Not two, but three.
But three.
But three.
Three is a magic number.
That's it.
So...
They come in teal and blue and orange.
That's right.
For the ladies.
And three shades of blue for the men. So there's a key phrase research tool called Sniper. There's a competitive intelligence tool called Recon, which is what helps with... figuring out how things are graded on a curve and things like that. And then there's a third tool called Scout that helps with theme relevance. It tells you what those supporting terms are and which ones you need to add to your content.
Can you say that again?
Here that was Scout.
Key phrase, research.
Research.
Sniper.
Yep.
What's the second one?
Second one is Recon.
Okay.
That's competitive intelligence.
Okay.
And the third one is Scout. That's content relevance.
What are the names?
Okay. So, let me pull up something here. I wanted to show you really quickly what one of the, part of the output is for Recon. It gives you a spreadsheet and a whole bunch of other stuff, but it gives you a nice Word document called an action step report that is like an executive summary with table of contents and everything. So this is a table that shows you which SEO factors are important and in what order of importance. This shows you for each SEO factor what range, maximum and minimum, your score needs to be in so that you can be competitive. And this is an example of a bar chart or a table. I won't go into the details, but it tells you who's threatening you, who is in position to knock you out of your spot and why, and who you might be able to knock out and how. So that's what you get in a nice Word document. And these three products are together in a bundle for $365. Lifetime license, unlimited upgrades, two installs.
That was in your lifetime or our lifetime?
Well, it depends. I'll just pick some 95-year-old guy Read the terms and conditions carefully. it's a desktop download, so you get a license, you get a download, and it's designed to run on PCs, but you can run it on Macs if you have a virtual machine or something like that. And if you're interested in checking it out, you can see a PDF and documentation and comments, testimonies, stuff like that. You can go to the following web address.
Such a polished sales presentation.
It's an IP address.
The following web address.
Is it really? No. No, it's not.
There is a geek
for it. Is that for real?
That's for real, because this is not available to the public. This special pricing is not available to the public.
I
created a shortcut URL, a Google-approved.net. We'll take you there. I'm just kidding.
So the IP address is 184.168.68.129. And then you need a page name. Legacy SEO Software Bundle. Legacy with a capital L, SEO, capital S, capital E, capital O, software, capital S, and bundle, capital B, dot HTML. So you can tell I don't want people to find this, can't you?
Yes. Well, it is well thought out.
In fact, I often reject sales because people do find it. And I see a purchase coming through, and I'm like, wait a minute, I don't know who you are. And I give them their money back. I said, you got to buy it at the regular price.
What's the regular price?
Yeah, so the Secret Service lookup table was given to him before you arrived today.
The regular price is $97 a month.
With no upgrades.
I was dying when you said one time. I was like, oh my God, you're dropping, leaving so much money on the table. But that's much better than $97 a month.
Video is 197.
Yeah, I mean, could have said 297 a month.
397.
That's right. Whatever he says, that's the price. I actually am going to be here tomorrow.
Oh, you are?
Yeah.
Oh, great. Okay. Perfect.
So people, you can chat with me, whatever, ask me questions.
Does this work internationally with different languages? I mean, you with all your languages?
Yes, with Scout. It works in 11 different languages, including Dutch.
Awesome.
I have a lot of Dutch users, actually, and they say it works perfectly.
That's right. That's why we dropped last year, yeah. Mike,
where do I go for updates?
I'll just send them to you. Because some of the recent updates that I put in won't work through my auto-update system. Part of it is because, you know, Yahoo Site Explorer, people would use that to find out backlinks, but that's gone now after the merger with Bing. So I had to find a totally different source for off-page information, and it uses Majestic SEO. And so you have to have, like, an access token and stuff like that.
What made you choose, this is just a curious question, what made you choose to do it as offline as opposed to an online?
Because
or just evolved that way.
No, because the data when it's gathered is gathered in real time, and if I do it from a server and you have it's either a crash the server or you'll burn out the IP address going to Google.
Right, and they'll start blocking it.
Right, and I tried a whole bunch of different systems of rotating IP proxies and stuff like that, but Google has just gotten way too smart with that. Yeah, I mean everything that's out there that's known, Google knows about it, and so you can only use it for a certain amount of time, and then you can't do it anymore. So that's why. So I use your IP address instead of mine.
Right. Right. What you should do is you should write it for everyone's music.
That's right. Why is my bandwidth being hogged by my machine? All right. So I have no idea what time it is.
Yeah. You're good. So Let's, we have Mickey Kennedy next. Take a quick break. Thank you, Mike.